I am mining investor and editor of Resource Stock Digest, head out of the Del Real, here with my partner, Mr. Nick Hodge, who's also an investor and the publisher of Bizarro World. We'll talk about that transition. This is the 365th episode of our weekly therapy session that we call Investing in Bizarro World, where we talk about markets, what we're investing in. We're going to talk about Donald Trump essentially suing us, the American taxpayer, so we could set up a fund so sex offenders and snitches and whoever he feels are worthy of his loyalty could get a slush fund and get paid out. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Massey election. We'll talk about winning the Iran war again. The markets are happy. Everything is awesome again for at least for the next minute or so before the market closes. We have another day tomorrow. Man, there's a lot to get to, Mr. Hodge. Before we get to some of that, how are you doing, sir?
I am not Gerardo Del Real, but I am behind for the day. It's been a busy week, as we were just talking about. And we're also going to talk about the top 1% vaginas. So a lot to look forward to in this episode here today. Some bizarro stuff that I got on the list. And of course, we'll start with markets. So happy to begin wherever you want.
No, let's get to the markets. I can't wait to talk about how you could pay, you know, you can get paid $15,000 to like put a fire emoji on a 1% vagina, but we'll get into that a little bit later on.
They don't go together.
You knew I was going to make the connection. We don't know. They don't go together, by the way. But anyhow, look, let's get to the markets before I keep going. Gold, nice reversal, right? It pierced that $4,500 level. Broke below it, turned immediately around, closed the day at 45.42. Ditto for silver, closing the day right near the $77 level. All of this, of course, on the heels of what looks like, once again, a framework for an agreement with Iran, where the remaining issues will be hashed out over the next 7 days, mediated by Pakistan. And so, look, I think... thankfully, by the way, I'm not even going to go do the Taco Trump thing or I'm glad we're backing up on this one. I don't see a way where a lot of our soldiers, more soldiers, don't get killed and our treasury isn't further depleted and our military isn't further damaged. And a ground war certainly wasn't going to be a walk in the park. So I am glad that at least for now, Thursday at 3 p.m., right? May the 21st, there seems to be some calm within the region with boats once again being allowed to go through the strait. Oil obviously reacted, going from 105, 106 down to the 97 level, and the U.S. dollar accordingly looked like it was going to break 100 again, and it's back closer to 99 than 100. So all of that to say, everything looks to be awesome again, Nick. Let's start with the metals, or we can start with your overall thoughts on the most recent iteration of an agreement with Iran.
Yeah, I'd like to start with the markets. We'll see what happens if this agreement holds or whatever. It's been sort of a volatile 2 months since the end of February, since this war started. I've certainly spent a few or more than a few billion dollars and lost more than a few lives, which is always unfortunate. Sort of said last week that the energy complex was starting to roll over and that oil was softening. That's still going to flow through to the rest of the economy and is flowing through to the rest of the economy. Again, as I said last week, you fill up your tank and you know all too well that costs are elevated. The CPI would go to above 4% with all these higher prices on the commodity inputs and the energy inputs. And so we've got that to deal with for likely the rest of the year. We get a new Fed chairman sworn in. I think it's today or tomorrow. He's going to have a really tough job. And we said last week that he can't really do anything unilaterally. He's got to get the votes of the Fed governors and the bank presidents. And so a really interesting spot to be in. You know, I had a neighbor text me the other day, you know, are these bond yields going to bring an end to the Iran war? And, you know, that's sort of above my pay grade. But you can sort of see that something was going to break. Either the war had to end or the Fed was going to have to intervene. And some say they're already intervening, you know, doing swaps with Nations, Middle Eastern nations, to, you know, keep them in their U.S. Treasury, so the bond market doesn't break any more than it's already broken, with the 30-year yield as high as it's been since, 2007, and we all know what happened after that, and the 10-year yield elevated as well. You know, there's no pricing in of any Fed rate cuts. If you look at the CME probabilities, the next probability, other than no change for the rest of the summer, is like a slight chance of a hike in the January meeting. So basically inaction on the rate front for the rest of the year. But nonetheless, bond yields have elevated themselves, which has also, as we've been talking about, given some headwinds to the precious metals in the short term. Like, gold dipped below near-term support. I think I was telling you last week it was something like, 4520, 4540. We saw a 4400 handle on gold, which doesn't give me warm and fuzzies in the near term. And silver broke down even worse than that since you and I spoke in the past week. I think it was, low 80s last week, and now we're in the low 70s. So the base inputs continue to be better or more robust. I was writing today, like, copper has held up better, lithium has held up better.
Yep.
Uranium's actually taken it on the chin. And I know I'm bouncing all over the place, but giving you sort of a whole macro update. And I mentioned uranium at the end of last week's episode, that if it continued to get weaker, that it would be a buying opportunity. And I do see some buying opportunities in the uranium complex. Maybe we can talk about that later. But what else? Copper still looks good, above $6.
There you go.
You mentioned the dollar was strengthening up there, sort of closed the gap that opened up a month or two ago. I'd have to look at the chart, which I actually do have in front of me. So maybe I'll do that right now. Yeah, it gapped down from basically 99.5 to 99.
96?
Yeah, well, 99, four. I'm talking about an early April.
Oh, got it, yeah.
Yeah. And then they actually gapped and then sort of, consolidated downward sideways to 97, 96 or so, and then has moved back up to 100. So that's a further headwind for the precious metals complex. And then, over on the stock side of things, everything is relatively awesome. Like, had a couple of down days in the S&P, but Nvidia earnings came out, market was up pretty good today. Volatility is non-existent in terms of the VIX, and so remains to be seen what's going to happen the rest of this year as that inflation works its way through and the growth starts to slow, which it is going to do. But for now, sort of a wonky time, hard to know what to believe. We've had so many truces and victories and ceasefires and all sorts of stuff that I'm still just taking it day by day.
Yeah, no, I think that was a great, great macro overview on all things. I was going to touch on the VIX. You touched on the VIX. I was going to touch on rates. We had said that the 10-year going above 4.5 would be a trigger point for this administration. They've proven that several times. And every time it touches above that 4.5 handle, they start panicking and they walk it back. They realize the amount of debt that they're going to have to refinance here in the second half of this year. And I think, that more than anything is leading to calmer heads prevailing. So again, I hope that continues to be the case. It's hard to have a lot of faith, given the track record of this administration. And we'll talk about some of the things that we've seen this week in regards to the influence of our government, and lobbying money from outside the country and what that can do to our national and local political scene, right? Which eventually affects everything. I mean, everything is connected, right? So we'll get into the Thomas Massey dethroning and how that came to be. But no, look, overall, I think you nailed it right on the head on the macro take. So I don't want to belabor it too much. I want to get into what the market is looking for and what the market is not looking for in regards to movements in certain equities. I won't name the certain equities here. I'll save that for the premium portion of the podcast. But
I might give them a freebie. We'll see.
Nick's feeling generous, y'all. I love it. I love it. Look at that. No, look, we had a company, and you're free to name it, but we have a company that we both follow that put out some really good results, some really good first phase results on a project that I really like that hadn't seen modern drilling in this portion of the project. It's a big, big, big system. It's a large project in elephant country. And the market, despite really solid results, we didn't get blockbuster numbers, but we got really solid results, sold it off some 27, 30% on heavy volume. So Not sure what the market was expecting, but they clearly wanted to see more grade and longer widths of higher grade. I contrast that with another company that did put out some higher grade results. And it's the inverse of Company A, because Company B surged some 27% on those results. And so it's definitely an interesting, finicky market here in late May. There's a lot of quality exploration that's about to kick up, especially in the James Bay region on the gold side, in Saskatchewan on the gold and the copper side. So Canada and the US to me look primed for a really, really good exploration campaign in the summertime. We'll start to get results from that in the late summertime. But clearly right now, the market wants high grade, baby. They don't care about solid. We've seen this with another company, you know, that's a large holding of mine that had great lithium and gold results for a first phase program. And the market basically shrugged and used it as a liquidity event. Thoughts on what the market wants and what it's rewarding? What it's rewarding is clear to me. But thoughts on just that kind of inverse relationship right now between the two?
Yeah, and I think I might just name the names, or not the one that you're talking about most recently there, but the two other ones, just so there's some transparency and accountability, and so people don't have to wonder what we're talking about. So, and they're names that we've talked about on this podcast before in the premium portfolio pick section, because they are in our premium portfolios in one way or another. We either finance them in private placement intel, or they're in one of your portfolios or my portfolios. And one is Daura Gold. You would say Daura, I'm sure.
Daura Gold.
Which has a very high quality project in Peru that they're waiting on social license and permits for. That's next door to Highlander Silver, which, as you corrected me last week, has a $1.7 billion market cap, not $170 million. Mm-hmm. And Daura has something like a $30 million market cap, less than that after today's action. But that's not the project we're talking about. You were referring to Elephant Country in Argentina, where they're drilling a project called Cerro Bayo, and they had, you know, pretty good results, you know, multiple meters of mostly silver driven, but pretty good in gold equivalent terms as well, including some visible silver. The project's called Cerro Bayo. It's in Argentina, as you said, has seen some previous past drilling. And this looks to be a new discovery. As we know, they're geologists, both on the Daura side and on the Latin Metal side, which is the project Vendor, are excited about the results. They're excited about what they saw in the core. They're excited about the results they got. They're excited that it came from multiple areas of the project. They're excited that this was only a small, you know, sub 2,000 meter initial first pass drilling, and they hit on essentially every hole. So that's all good. You know, a couple of things to talk about, I guess. You know, one is structure. You know, there were some people who came in before us in Daura Gold, some brokers and their followings and otherwise, that aren't as keen on structuring things the way our group structures things. I think that, you know, we've been talking about it for the past couple of weeks. At least I've been covering both Latin and Daura in Underground Alpha, and have mentioned it a couple of times at the end of this podcast. And so, you know, maybe some of the blame is on me for, you know, pumping the tires a little bit too much and setting the expectations too high. And so that there was room to fall is what I'm saying. You know, the shares closed yesterday, something like 39 or 39.5 cents, and then sold down to 30 cents or thereabout today. So, you know, maybe it was a creation of a sell the news type event, right? We're also in quite cheap. Not that I was selling today, but, you know, we financed Daura at 6 cents. And so when it's at 35 cents, you can do the math on, you know, what a 500% upside is, and people willing to take some off the table, especially because there's warrants at 10 cents. So all that to say, I know one of the backers of the company, and he said it was okay if I quoted him, Jeff Phillips, was in the market buying today, you know, hundreds of thousands of shares. So the smart money, and those that know the company well, are very encouraged by the results. And then I got a text from or a screenshot of a text from a former VP of Rio Tinto. So you can assume this gentleman is no slouch. And it says something to the effect of, You know, the market today has completely misunderstood your results in Argentina. Not unusual, as the market can be very dumb. And he said he's going to buy a shitload of stock after basically the monkeys got out of the market in the first half of the day. So a lot to like from the Dara Gold results, even if the market didn't initially understand or didn't like the results or sold the news or however you want to frame that. And then another one.
Before we go on, though, really quick. Yeah, I want to provide context on why we like the results, right? 16.35 meters of 88.96 grams per ton silver from 28 meters. 15 meters of 120.8 grams per ton silver from 58 meters. That included 2 meters of 427 grams per ton silver. 3.6 meters of 389.8 grams per ton silver from 86 meters. And then if you're going, well, okay, but the gold was weak. Well, you move out a little bit and they hit 11.95 meters of 2 grams per ton gold. Again, shallow all the way across. And so when I look at the fact that they're getting good widths, they're getting good grade, they're getting good grade in both the silver and the gold. Yes, parts of the system are more silver rich. Parts of the system are more gold rich. These types of systems are notorious for that. And the fact that this was a limited first phase program to try to get a better idea of the system and in which way things were going and which way things were open. I don't understand the sell-off other than people waiting on results to use it as a liquidity event. So yeah, the stock down 25% today. I'll remind everybody, for everybody that sold, you know, they had people on the other side like Jeff Phillips, more than happy to buy that on the counsel of, you know, Jeff's geologist. And on top of that, you know, people like the former VP of Rio Tinto saying, I think his quote was, these are excellent results. These are phenomenal results. Like, you're in elephant country and you're hitting gold and silver over wide widths. And you now have a better idea of how to vector into some of the higher grade, richer parts of the system. So again, I think the market is looking for, you know, Trident resources types of results, which are in a different part of the world with different, infrastructure. And so you need the higher grades of those types of results. And Trident is worth mentioning because of the fact that it's been absolutely knocking it out of the park and the market has rewarded it. I know that you wanted and will highlight the company that was up 27%, the one that I referenced earlier. But to give you an example of Trident's results here, about 3 weeks ago, they hit 15 grams per ton gold over 52 meters down at like some 300 meters. That's not the norm, folks. It took them a little bit to figure that system out. That's just the way that it goes. You start by vectoring into the system and then learning more about it as you go. And so I know the Dowda people are excited for the phase two program. They're working now on new targets. I think it's a heck of an opportunity at these levels. I think it's a heck of an opportunity if you discount the entirety of this project, which I really like, and you just look at the project in Peru, right? The Antonella project, which is right next to, as you mentioned, the $1.7 billion Highlander silver, with the mineralization clearly crossing over onto its property. So yeah, I just want to provide the context on why we like the results. It's shallow. There's good silver grades. There's good gold grades. They didn't miss on any of the holes, and they got a lot more coming.
Yeah, they have $2 million to drill the phase two, which they've already committed to. And so a lot to look forward to there. The other one, and you're getting a lot for your money today, which is free, this portion of the podcast, is Gladiator Metals. So that's another company that we've featured on this podcast and is in, I believe you cover Gladiator. Well, I cover Gladiator Metals in Underground Alpha. I'm not correct. I'm not sure if you cover it or not. Has fantastic results. This is the White Horse Copper Project in Yukon, and up, as you said, some 27-30% today to new 52-week highs, right? Now approaching the getting close to the $2 level at this point. And I'll just read the numbers to give you the context. 28 meters of 1.57% copper, half a gram per ton gold, and 16.86 grams per ton silver. Another 17.2 meters of 2.9% copper and nearly 1 gram per ton gold. What else? 40 meters of 2% copper and 0.7 gram a ton silver. And these are relatively shallow holes in what is a new discovery. So the White Horse It's a skarn copper deposit, a past producer. We know that there's copper there because it produced in the past, but through geophysics and other exploration work over the past 6 months to a year, they've really been able to figure out the controls on this mineralization and have made this new discovery at Cub East. And that was one of the main objectives of this. It's a big drill campaign. It's 45,000 meters they're trying to drill this year. And that was one of the main initiatives, is to prove up this new discovery at Cub East. And they certainly did that today. And there should be a lot more coming. So their main deposit is Cali, where they're going to be working on a resource update there. Results pending for that. And then they're going to take some additional, you know, exploration or blue sky shots at targets like one called Great Southern. So really just getting started on Gladiator, with a lot of news to come. And you can really just see the juxtaposition if you look at the response to DAR's results and the response to Gladiator's results. So again, different part of the world, closer to infrastructure, higher grade, past producer, versus something that the market is still trying to figure out if it's a new discovery with DARA, and I and others are pretty sure it is. So do with that information as you will, but just some of the stuff that we're seeing out there in the copper market. The other thing that's encouraging is that, you know, those good results are being rewarded on the copper side of things, right? We said earlier that also, you know, precious metals have been softer, silver has been softer, whereas, you know, copper remains at or near all-time highs. And so perhaps partially a reflection of that as well.
Well said. Well said. We're definitely going to give the premium portion of the podcast group that pays to hear that portion its money's worth as well. We have a couple of names and a couple of updates to provide you that are important catalysts here moving forward. So we'll get to that here in just a bit. But we can't get to, you know, talking about the overall market and the global economy and Iran without talking about the factors that influence the decision to take on as the United States, right? I mean, I think this war makes all the sense for Israel. They've been at it trying to get someone on the U.S. side to do it since the 90s. When Bill Clinton, I think, reminded Israel with the famous quote saying, you know, Israel came in and basically said, hey, we want you to do this. And Clinton responded by saying, who's the superpower here? Which is the response that it's gotten for the last three, four administrations. So let's be clear. I don't like either side. I lead quite libertarian, which leads a segue into the Massey election, which I'm getting to. But the last four administrations, for all of Obama's war crimes and financial bailing out of the banks and Donald Trump's, you know, just probably one of the most corrupt, if not the most corrupt. There are several articles today. You can trust the media or not, but several articles from different institutions just basically saying this is the most corrupt presidency in history. And it's not even close. To Bill Clinton's scandals in the White House in the late 90s, which seem mild by today's standards, to George Bush Jr. and, you know, his baiting us into Iraq and getting us into a 1920 year war that did nothing but deplete our treasure and bring misery to the people out there. I say all that to say that all those administrations had a hand in covering up the Epstein files. All those administrations have been warmongers. But what those administrations didn't do, even the Clintons, which were notoriously corrupt, was be as brazen with the corruption, right? And so when I see us into a war with Iran and I see Thomas Massey being one of two Republicans, the other being Marjorie Taylor Greene, which was already kind of booted out by Trump earlier this year and dethroned from her position. Thomas Massey, a local seat in Kentucky that he's had for, I think, you know, I forget how many terms. When I see, I believe it was $15 million from AIPAC money in a total of something like $32 million. Don't hold me to that number. I may be off by a couple of million on the APEC side and on the total number sign, but I could tell you that it was the most expensive congressional race in the history of our country. We're celebrating the 250th year of our country this year. This was the most foreign money and most expensive lobbying effort to unseat a gentleman who, by all accounts, voting record-wise, is one of the most conservative Republicans and was praised by J.D. Vance for many years, was praised by Trump, was praised by everybody. he was defeated with bottom line outside lobbying money and a good chunk of it from AIPAC, right, which is the Israeli lobby. It's not a coincidence that Thomas Massie just introduced a bill to force AIPAC to file as a foreign agent, which is what it is. It's a foreign lobbying agency. Look, if I'm Israel, I'm trying to do the same thing. I'm lobbying for as much power as well. If I'm America, if I'm an elected leader, I'm trying to make sure, as Mr. Trump said so brilliantly, he markets well both terms. He wanted to make America first and make America great again, right? But instead, what I'm seeing is we're seeing foreign money come in and directly influence our elections. And that's not, I don't have the tinfoil hat on today, folks. That's not me saying it. AIPAC said it. I went to their Twitter feed. They were bragging about it. They said they were happy to finally have two people. There was another race that was also AIPAC dominated that would take a pro-Israel stance, that they were happy to have put them in place and in position. And so that's not a rumor anymore. That's not a tinfoil hat conspiracy theory. That just is where we are in America right now. To the corruption part, I don't know if you have any. Well, let me get your thoughts on that, Nick, before I go to the corruption part of it.
Well, it's just disheartening, right, when you get a candidate who resonates with folks on both sides of the political spectrum, who garners the respect of folks like you and I, who lean libertarian, who you know, stands by his principles and votes you know, with America First, which is, you know, what the MAGA people say they are, that he can be ostracized like that. You know, he says that America doesn't need a yes man, right? They need someone who votes with the Constitution, which I'm very much in favor of. And that's what he did. And so, yeah, it's disheartening that whenever someone like that gains traction, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat or an independent or a libertarian, they're ostracized, right? And they're pushed out of the mainstream and out of the spotlight by what has become a uniparty, which is a phrase I mentioned last week and one that I'm seeing more and more. You know, I can remember the poo-pooing of folks like Ron Paul or Justin Amash from Michigan, for example. And so they don't want those folks who have principles, who vote with the Constitution, who want transparency shined or shown on, you know, the darkest corners of our democracy, specifically the Epstein case. When you start bringing that stuff to the fore, you're immediately on the wrong side of not just the Washington political establishment, but Israel, which you just talked about as well. And yes, Israel newspapers were running articles with headlines talking about how, you know, the most important political race for Israel was in little old Kentucky, for example. And so it reversed again fast. Last week I was saying that on the poly market, Massey was up something like 65% in terms of odds, and then deteriorated from there over the past week. And the other thing I'd say is shame on you voters for being susceptible to that stuff. You know, I'm not, and I don't think you are saying the election was rigged in any way. People obviously voted out Thomas Massey. They're gullible, naive, susceptible to political marketing and maneuvering that's financed by those record amount of dollars that were coming in. I would have to mention the fourth turning, because it was clearly a vote not on party lines, because it was a Republican primary, but it was on age lines. If you look at the age breakdown, the younger cohorts, the millennials and the Zers, they voted for Thomas Massie. I think they understood what was at stake, and they understood that he was the quality candidate. It was the older folks, the boomers and older, that voted in the other gentleman, right? Gallrain, or however you say it. And so in those terms, you got to wait for those folks to die. I mean, there's no other way to say that. That's what the fourth turning is about, the turning over of the generations. And shame on those folks for being so gullible and susceptible and tribal that they blindly kowtow to, you know, the leader of the MAGA party, right?
Yeah, I will say this. It's a small congressional district in Kentucky that was up for grabs, but a very influential one, right? Because of Massey's consistent votes alongside the Constitution and this administration's, you know, relentless attack on so many of the constitutional amendments that we have, right? And so I'm not saying it was rigged, but there were 10,000 mail-in ballots, which I was told was anti-democratic anytime there is a major election. So, you know, it, in a race where the total number of votes for Massey, I think, was something like 60 or 70,000, and he lost by a few thousand to the other gentleman, 10,000 mail-in ballots seems like a high number. But again, I haven't verified it, and I don't know that it's true or not. What I do know is that it was absolutely the foreign lobby and money and the donors that have been for this war, that have been for keeping the Epstein files hidden. That was the money that unseated Thomas Massey. That is a fact. That is public record. And so, yeah, a disheartening moment in our time, absolutely in line with the fourth turning, as is the corruption from the Trump administration. Two things. I'll be quick because I know we're running long and we got the premium portion and we got to talk about 1% vaginas. And we got to talk about fire emojis for those 1% vaginas. Look, RJ Reynolds walked in to the White House a few days ago and was like, "Hey, buddy, I got $5 million for you and your buddies and your administration. Would you like my $5 million? And the Trump administration was like, "We will take that donation. Thank you very much, RJ Reynolds." And then several days later, RJ Reynolds said, "Hey, we got these restrictions on our flavored vapes that have been known to cause lung cancer, especially in young kids, because we really like targeting them. So we use like purple magic flavors and like cherry bomb and like super cotton candy flavors and all of this, right? It's clear marketing. It's been ruled on that they were targeting and being predatory towards kids with the way that they market their little Juuls vapes that are so popular with so many of these kids and are shown to be highly addictive." 3 days later, guess what? The Trump administration walks into RFK Jr., who, by the way, is their Secretary of Health, for those of you not aware. And they say, "Hey, like, we know you're kind of against this, but can you just drop those regulations over here against RJ Reynolds? They're a good group of guys and gals over there. I think we're being tough on them." So guess what happened today or yesterday? "No more regulations for you. We're going to loosen those up. You go target them kids and you go get them." That's essentially what happened. So it's amazing to me that all it takes is $5 million. That it's amazing to me that how much money came into the Massey race. It's amazing to me that people continue to buy this stuff. And if that wasn't enough, you know, Mr. Trump decided that he didn't want to release his tax returns. And so they were leaked way back when he was president last time by his commissioner. And it wasn't just his. There was like a leak of thousands of records, but his were included. And he didn't like that very much. And, you know, subsequent audits have happened and subsequent audits have proven that he owes hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes. And so what he did was he decided he was going to sue his IRS. It's his administration that's in charge of this, right? For $10 billion. And then when it was time to go to court to prove the suit up, because it wasn't going to hold up, the IRS, his IRS decided, "We'll settle with you for $1.7 billion. And so then the Trump administration said, "Well, we'll take it. But not only do we want $1.7 billion, we want to be able to set that up in a what they call a weaponization fund so we can, you know, give that to whoever we want to give it to. January 6th rioters are not exempt. You know, that includes 33 of them that have been arrested for sexual offenses, including several minors since then. That includes many that were beating cops up for all my Thin Blue Line folks out there and cop supporters up there. Big supporter of law enforcement here. I don't like to see him on the other side of that stuff. So they're not exempt from receiving this money. I'm not saying they're going to receive all of it. But James Tallarico, a known informant and snitch, was on X, you know, posting that he felt entitled to $1.5 to $2.5 million because he feels like he's been persecuted by the government over the last several years for his involvement in stuff. And he's just one example, right? And so that's bad enough, right? Because us, the taxpayer, we're the ones footing the bill for this $1.7 billion fund. If that wasn't enough, the last condition that Trump negotiated with his own IRS and the Department of Justice was that from now until infinity, him and his family would never receive another audit, nor could they be prosecuted for crimes committed before or after the settlement. And to that, folks, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how much clearer as day it has to be that we're getting pimped out.
And it comes out this week that, you know, Trump is trading stocks as well, some of which, you know, have direct responses to some of the legislation that or guidance or regulations that he has control over and has affected. So that is complete and utter bullshit and abuse of power. And I'll give it to both sides. You know, it's the same, you know, imagine if Biden had done this stuff, right? I mean, Biden only, you know, protected his son, which was also bullshit, but this is.
And he just like Latinas and crack. Like,
this is like, I think Hunter Biden's on Twitter now, by the way. And some people were like, I feel like I know you, bro. I've seen your cock. Anyway, it's ridiculous that, you know, you can shield yourself and your family from IRS investigation. And those of us that pay significant sums to the IRS continue to have to do that and are subject to audits and liens when we don't pay into the coffers, by the way, of which we're behind $39 trillion on again as of this week. And the money that incomes there is nowhere near the outcome, i.e. we have significant deficits. So, no, this is in your face abuse of power, and it's pretty clear what's going on that front. I'm going to walk backwards on some of the things you said. The R.J. Reynolds, which is really British American Tobacco, I'm not sure how I feel about that. As you know, someone who tries to stay tried and true to libertarian, I'd like to let the people make their own decisions. Yeah, they're marketing to kids, I suppose. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. You know, lots of folks vape that, you know, used to be smokers or find it a different alternative or whatever. And so I'm in favor of letting the people decide. The stocks clearly responded, and I pay kind of close attention to those tobacco stocks. I've talked about them on this podcast before. I've recommended them in Foundational Profits. British American Tobacco, which is ticker BTI, is at a 52-week high on the back of that announcement. Altria, ticker MO, is doing really good as well, as is Philip Morris, ticker PM. They're all paying, you know, 4-5% dividends, have relatively low PEs, PE valuations, and are decent stocks to own, no matter how you feel about that decision. Zins are also hugely popular in the Trump administration and elsewhere. Obviously, I see them all over on the T-ball field for my kids, you know, guys, you know, talking on YouTube and TV. And even I think, you know, RFK Jr., speak of him earlier, you mentioned him, like, folks in the administration, there was an article came out this week, are hugely into the Zins. And so they're hugely popular. All that to say, yeah, the stocks are a decent group of stocks to own. What else did I want to get out? I know you want to get to the premium portion, but I had two other things I wanted to get out.
No, we talked about Latinas and crack and Hunter Biden. We can't talk about that without talking about 1% vagina.
I'm going to get there in a second. But before, I wanted to get out two market take things. Before I do the bizarre world stuff on the vaginas. One is this thing called Nat Gold, which I've mentioned before, and I should have done it after we talked about Gladiator and Dara, because it tied in pretty good, but we skipped ahead kind of fast there. You know, these companies, the entire mining industry, junior, intermediate, and senior, is focused on the extraction of economic assets. They're extractive industries. They spend significant amounts of capital proving up a deposit, as we talk about here every week, trying to make a discovery, prove it's economic, do economic studies, preliminary economic assessments, pre-feasibility studies, and then feasibility studies, including BFSs, bankable feasibility studies, all in the effort to attract additional financing to get through the permitting and regulatory hurdles and then make a construction decision to finance and build a mine. That's what the entire industry is about. There's this new coin, which is gearing up for launch, because I see the marketing reaching a fever pitch. And I mentioned it in this podcast before as a warning, who is buying up in assets from the mining industry that have been proven to be sub-economic and bastardized, and they are acquiring them, and they are attaching a token to it, giving it what I would say is a bullshit valuation. They're giving it like an in-situ valuation. Like you would say, oh, there's 1 million ounces in the ground. The all-in sustaining cost of producing that gold is $1,500. So that gold is worth 1 million times $1,500. And they're trying to assign that kind of value to their coin. And they're going to sell a token based on that sort of valuation. One mine they bought the other day is in Idaho. It's not a mine, obviously. It's a historic deposit. It's called the Friday Mine, or the Friday Project. Not Lucky Friday, Friday. It was owned most recently, at least partially owned, by Giant Mining Corp, ticker BFG. It wasn't even their main asset. It was what you would call a non-core asset of that company. That company, BFG, had a copper project they were working on, and that didn't work out. So now they're rolling back their shares, changing their name, and they're shedding their non-core assets, i.e., for example, e.g., I guess in this case, for example, the Friday Mine, which Nat Gold has now purchased. So these are sub-economic non-core assets of failed junior mining companies that you're buying, putting them in your portfolio on your balance sheet, and then selling coins and calling it a store of value or value in the ground. And the pitch is that you shouldn't. They're saying the mining
industry is the best.
The mining industry is dumb. Their tagline is, it just makes sense. And they're saying, why drill? That's like some of the marketing language. Like, why drill? Why spend money on drilling? Like, just take these inferred, sometimes not even indicated assets, consider it a store of value in the ground and assign a monetary value for it. It's the exact opposite of what the largest and all mining companies in the world try to do, which is prove that they're economic and get the gold out of the ground. If it's just sitting there without an economic viability, how can you assign any value to it unless you're a charlatan or worse? And so anyway, caveat emptor, buyer beware on this Nat Gold coin, because the marketing is ramping up. I see that they're starting to do the pre-sales and all that sort of stuff that happens in the crypto market, the drops and all that sort of stuff. And I think they're going to IPO a related NASDAQ company of like the parent company that owns the Nat Gold thing. So the whole thing, excuse my French, it fucking reeks. And I would just be aware.
There you go.
That's the one thing. And the other thing I wanted to get out is separate from that. I wrote a nice new long report for premium members of this podcast that is now up on the website. So there was one already up there. Or there was maybe two already up there about, you know, why you don't need an advisor to buy the S&P and how to invest in a bizarre world and some of the things that we talk about. But I just wrote a pretty robust one. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit long, but
no, this is great.
It's about essentially the theory of a permanent portfolio, which was first put forward by Harry Brown, which is 25% cash, 25% bonds, 25% gold, and 25% stocks, and then, you know, balanced out or rebalanced on an annual basis to get back to your 25% holdings. And they view that as the permanent portfolio, right? A way to withstand inflations, deflations, growth cycles, contraction cycles, et cetera. And it's done pretty well. There's a mutual funds that were based on that starting in the 1980s that have delivered over 7% per year, even in some years in which the S&P was down. And that's been riffed on by a number of folks. Like Ray Dalio's Bridgewater is famously based on this. And that was, you know, one of the best performing hedge funds ever. He added a commodity component to it. And then Porter Stansberry a couple of years ago had a big write-up called Porter's Permanent Portfolio, where he was riffing on those things. And he added some insurance companies, for example, instead of owning bonds, own insurance companies because they're experts in managing bonds. And so export the expertise to them. Instead of owning the bonds directly and instead of owning the S&P, for example, he said you should own high quality companies called Lindy Forever Companies. I won't give away his whole bag. But so this is not a new idea, but it's an important idea and it's one that you should be aware of as an investor. I know it's sort of not your flavor, Gerardo, but it's good to know about and it's good to know what the components are. And so I put together a couple of permanent portfolios. I called them fail-safe portfolios for the bizarro world. And I gave the ETFs that you could own to effectuate those strategies in terms of bonds and cash and gold. I added some royalty companies in there. I added some commodities in there, both hard and soft in the style of Bridgewater. And then I gave four templates for it, like a more aggressive one, a truly permanent or balanced one. You know, one that's for folks closer to retirement, like a conservative one. And then one for folks who like don't trust anything, like anti-government, anti-dollar folks. So it's quite long. I think it's like 20 or 25 pages, but it's for paid members of Investing in Bizarro World Live, which is different from the free podcast. which is also different, I should say, while I'm on it. Just the Bizarro World Daily Editorial, which Correct. Is now the front-facing editorial starting next week after Memorial Day here in the United States, and Happy Victoria Day to those in Canada who celebrated this past Monday. There will be no more Daily Profit Cycle. The Daily Editorial will be Bizarro World, because why the hell not, given everything that we talked about in this episode, including what we're about to talk about, the top 1% of vaginas and the $15,000 fire emojis. So that's it for my hot air. I had to get all that out.
Hunter Biden heaven as it would be. 1% vaginas and fire emojis.
You ready?
Yeah. It's funny. I got to say, one of the funniest jokes on X that I saw the other day was like a meme, and somebody said why it wasn't Hunter Biden. If he was so bad, why wasn't he in the Epstein files? And somebody responded, because he only liked Latinas and crack. He wasn't into kids. So that provides the perfect segue to 1% vaginas. What exactly is a 1% vagina, Mr. Hodge?
Well, it's a healthy hoo-ha.
You have my attention.
It's a healthy hoo-ha, which is the name of the subreddit thread where some of this information has come to the fore but is now being written about. and let me get up the article so I get some of my facts right here. But this sort of started with Mr. Brian Johnson, who, Jordan, I don't know if you're familiar with. He is a Silicon Valley tech entrepreneur and venture capitalist. He famously founded and ran Braintree, which is a back-end e-commerce solution. We, in fact, used it at one point for some of our e-commerce endeavors. It eventually bought Venmo, and then both of those were sold to, I believe, PayPal it was in 2013 or something like that for like 800. I don't want to get it wrong. I guess it was 800 million bucks or something like that. Yeah, that sounds about right. So super rich guy, and he's famously been trying to cheat death. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter. I'm sure there was a documentary
on Netflix about him. Correct. Yeah. I recall now.
And him and his girlfriend are on the social medias. He's always tweeting about, you know, what he's doing to cheat death, exercise, health, diet. And the other day he tweets that he just performed oral sex on his girlfriend. And she has a top 1% vagina because... there is a test, and the company that provides the test, and this is, you know, what this is all about here. Let me find the name of it. I should have had this ready to go. I'm sorry. But they provide a test. Where the fuck is it? Evvy, E-V-V-Y. They provide a test, an at-home test, that women can perform on their vaginas, and it tells them about the bacterial ecosystem that is in their vaginas, good bacteria, bad bacteria, et cetera, and then provides, you know, based on the findings of your vagina, supplements or probiotics or things that you can take to alter. And some... this is par for the course in the world we live in, right? You can test your dog's DNA. You can test your DNA, all that sort of stuff. You can, you know, do all sorts of stuff. Get your markers, get your blood tested, figure out what's going on. Well, now the startup, Evvy, has served more than 100,000 patients. And after Brian Johnson's tweet about his girlfriend's top 1% vagina, they had something like, what was the increase here? It was... There was like a number. Sales spiked 2,000% in the first 48 hours after the tweet. And there's a whole subreddit thread called Healthy Hoo-Has, which I thought was alliteratively funny, where women are now obsessing over the health of their vaginas, and they are comparing the percentages of healthy bacteria they have. And there's, in some cases, vaginal envy of women who don't have as high a percentage of good bacteria as the others. So I'll stop there on the Healthy Hoo-Has, but I thought that was one... a light way to get in some Bizarro World content. And two, this shows you where we're at in the world in terms of science and self-diagnosis, et cetera. And I guess I should add that some women have found success. Like the article I read on Wired was talking about one woman who was having issues, who couldn't figure it out through traditional science and medicine, her OBGYN and family doc, you know, wasn't giving her the time of day, didn't believe her symptoms, yada, yada. She did this test, did what they said with the probiotics, the supplements or whatever, and turned out to be correct. Like, your symptoms were alleviated. So that's great, I suppose. But That's just where we're on the world. We're tweeting about venture capitalists, multimillionaires, and oral sex and healthy hoo-has.
And fire emojis.
Oh, you want me to keep going?
You got to talk about the fire emojis. I find this hilarious, fascinating, and I get. And again, jokes aside, it is exactly where we're at in the world, and it my brain, right? It's a little weird.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it ties into perfectly to the Massey thing, right?
100%. So, you may have seen on the Twitter, the TikTok, the social media, an epidemic of breaking news and developing stories and fire emojis and things like that in terms of influencers. And we know about influencers in some respects because we use them for some of the marketing programs that we do. So I know how some of that works. You can hire these folks who have large followings on those social media platforms to talk about things, whatever you want, products, companies, and in this case that I'm going to talk about, politicians, right? The difference with some of the stuff we do is that it all has to be disclosed, right? We have to, the influencer has to say in the content and have in the disclaimers that they've been paid to talk about this company or this opportunity or whatever it is. In politics, it's not so clear, surprise, surprise. And so what we learned this week is there's lots of money in this influencer culture that's been paying folks with large followers. And this New York Times article starts off with one who was shilling for Tom Steyer, who's running for governor in California. The influencer, his name is Carlos Espina, he's in Tejas, has 14.5 million followers on TikTok. And he was making videos talking about, you know, why he was endorsing Tom Steyer for governor of California. What was missing from his videos and from any fine print in his videos is that he was paid $100,000 by the Steyer campaign to do so. And, you know, this gets into gray areas because some of the three-lettered agencies, like, for example, let me see if I can find it here, if I can go fast. The Federal Election Commission, the agency that monitors political spending, says that traditional political advertising rules, they don't apply to social media. So that's the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. They say, nope, we don't monitor the social media, don't have to do it. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, says the same thing. And they regulate deceptive business practices. And while if you're shilling for a product like vagina test, for example, you've got to say that you've been paid to shill for the vagina test. But if you're shilling for a politician, the FTC says it does not regulate political advertisements. So the question becomes, who's regulating all this and where's the disclosure? One of the main workarounds is the campaigns and the influencers are saying that they're being hired as consultants. And so this gets buried in political financial disclosures that they hired XYZ influencer to become a consultant and a surrogate of the campaign. And they're not paid for the individual posts or the individual videos that they make to shill for whatever politician it is. This is happening on both sides of the aisle. You have to imagine it occurred in the case of Massey, where the boomers are blindly following shit that they see on Facebook, including what I've been told is an absolute AI content created cesspool. I'm not on the Facebook, so I don't know. But even some of the popular influencers, and that's where the fire emoji comes in. So, and this is something that I've noticed just in my, you know, heart of hearts and in my browsing. I've even made tweets like, I'm going to start blocking and unfollowing these breaking news accounts because I just can't take it. Like everything is fucking breaking. Yeah. Everything is a fire emoji. And it's just over the top. And you can see, that it's not reality. Well, and one of the worst offenders and someone that I unfollowed long ago, I think I might have even talked about on this podcast, is Dom Luker. And let me see if I can find it here. Dom Luker. So this is a conservative guy who makes posts, including ones that support President Trump, that are viewed millions of times. Turns out this guy is charging $15,000 per X post or Twitter post if it starts with a fire emoji and has the capital word breaking on it. $15,000 for the fire emoji breaking to get your political message out there without him having to disclose who is paying the money. So anyway, that's the elevator pitch or the 30,000 foot view of this. But you can imagine how much money is in politics if in just this example, $15,000 per tweet, or in the Tom Steyer example, $100,000 for one influencer. And it's the absolute Wild West. No disclosure and therefore no accountability, right? So just careful who you follow and who you're believing in the social media world. That should go without saying. But now we're getting a little bit more peek behind the curtain of how it truly works.
It's getting tricky out there, folks. Unless you're a part of the Epstein files, you guys go be all right. hopefully everybody got their money's worth on the free portion of the podcast. We're about an hour in. I think we should get to the premium portion of the podcast because there's definitely some good stuff to get into. Have a great weekend. Thank you for hanging out. This was the 365th episode of our weekly therapy session. Clearly, we needed one this week that we call Investing in Bizarro World. I think this might have been the longest one on record. Had a blast. Have a great weekend. Have a great week, everybody.
See ya.